From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A briefing Tuesday at the United Nations in New York City addressed a number of the hot spots in the world, beginning with the situation in Yemen. This was the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stefan Dujarric.
Just on the first on the meetings are regarding prisoner exchange. The meeting of the Supervisory Committee on the Implementation of the Prisoner Exchange Agreement for Yemen began in Amman today. Martin Griffiths, the special envoy, said at the outset this is an important meeting and it will lay the basis for the next step, which will be to see the release of prisoners. He made clear that the prisoner exchange is an important issue as it touches the lives of thousands of Yemeni families waiting to be reunited with their loved ones. Also, the implementation of the agreement will help confidence-building measures among the parties on other issues. The committee also includes representatives of the government of Yemen, Ansar al-Allah, and is co-chaired by the special envoy and the International Committee for the Red Cross. Also on Yemen, in Hodeidah, Lieutenant General Michael Lolesgaard assumed his duties as the chair of the Redeployment Coordination Committee and head of the UN mission to assist on the Hodeidah agreement, and that is of this evening. Houthi and government of Yemen representatives on the RCC have been continuing to meet yesterday and today aboard the UN vessel that is berthed in Hodeidah. The parties have engaged in a long and intense discussions both yesterday and today in order to find mutually acceptable solutions and associated timelines for the implementation of the Hodeidah provisions of the Stockholm Agreement. The RCC chair, who chaired the meetings yesterday and today, General Kammert, commended both parties for demonstrating goodwill and engaging constructively together to overcome trust issues and to find viable solutions that would eventually demilitarize the ports and the city of Hodeidah, facilitate life-saving humanitarian operations. Weeks of sustained engagement by the chair and his team are beginning to pay off. Today, the parties are closer to agreeing to modalities for phase one of redeployment than they were 6 weeks ago. They're also grappling with the complexities of disengaging forces in close proximity of each other and the gradual deployment of heavy weapons, armor, and infantry. The parties are fully aware of the international spotlight on their efforts to implement the Hodeidah agreement and its implications in the broader peace process for Yemen. Back here in the Security Council, the Executive Director of the UN Office for Drugs and Crime, Yuri Fedotov, noted that two-thirds of the world's surface is ocean, most of which is not subject to a single state's criminal jurisdiction. He said that transnational maritime crime is increasingly sophisticated and expanding. This was part of an open Security Council meeting on transnational organized crime at sea. And his remarks have been shared with you. Turning to Syria, our humanitarian colleagues remain gravely concerned for the thousands of people fleeing the last Daesh areas in Hajin in Syria's southeastern Deir ez-Zor governorate, as well as for those civilians who remain in the area. Those fleeing report many civilian casualties, including women and children, large-scale destruction of civilian infrastructure, and shortage of food and medicine. Since December of 2018, more than 25,000 people have arrived from the Hajin area to the Al-Hol camp in Al-Hasake governorate, effectively tripling the camp's population to some 35,000 people, and that is surpassing the maximum capacity. Since the 22nd of January, around 10,000 people have arrived at the site. As of yesterday, 35 children have reportedly died either en route or shortly after arriving in the camp since December, mostly from hypothermia. The UN and humanitarian partners are continuing to scale up the responses at the camp. 24-hour teams have been set up to receive the newly displaced, quickly identify the most vulnerable cases, and provide urgent assistance, including medical and protection support. The UN continues to call on all parties to the conflict and those with influence over them to take all measures to ensure the protection of civilians and civilian infrastructure in line with their obligations under international humanitarian law. And the UN and the Libyan Government of National Accord today launched the 2019 humanitarian and response plan for the country, seeking $202 million to provide health, support, protective, water and sanitation, shelter and education to support more than 550,000 vulnerable people. 7 years of instability and insecurity have taken a heavy toll on the well-being of tens of thousands of children, women and men in Libya, with thousands of families unable to afford food, water, basic household items. According to the Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, at least 823,000 people across Libya, including 250,000 children, are in need of humanitarian assistance. This includes internally displaced people and returnees, conflict-affected people, host communities, and refugees and migrants who face grave human rights violations and abuse in the absence of the rule of law. You can find the humanitarian response plan for Libya online. Also in Libya, the World Health Organization today warned of increasing attacks on health facilities and workers. The agency has documented more than 41 attacks targeting health workers and facilities across the country over the past year. These attacks resulted in 6 health workers and patients being killed, 25 health workers injured. Additional 7 health workers were also assaulted during the period. More information online. And today is Safer Internet Day, and our colleagues at the UN Children's Fund are highlighting the dangers posed to young people by online violence, cyberbullying, and digital harassment. According to the data from UNESCO on the prevalence of cyberbullying in high-income countries, the proportion of children and adolescents who are affected by cyberbullying ranges from 5 to 21%, with girls appearing to be more likely to experience cyberbullying than boys. In a statement issued today, the executive director of UNICEF, Henrietta Fore, called for greater action to make the internet a safer place for everyone, adding that it is time for governments, families, academia, and the private sector to put children and young people at the center of digital policies. More information online. And today we also officially celebrate the Lunar New Year. 2019 is the year of the pig. And in his message, the Secretary General sent his best wishes to those celebrating and said the new year is an opportunity to join hands to build a peaceful and prosperous world for all, leaving no one behind. That is it. I just want to flag, tomorrow at 11 a.m. in the visitors' lobby, the UN Population Fund will launch a photo exhibit to mark the International Day of Zero Tolerance against Female Genital Mutilation. The exhibit sheds light on harmful practices that is still prevalent in many parts of the world. You're welcome to attend. And today we say thank you to Montenegro and Österreich. 37. There we go. Joe, you get the question.
Thank you.
Yield.
Thank you. Particularly in light of the recent observance of the remembrance of the Holocaust at the UN and the Secretary General's statements with respect to that observation and remembrance, I'd like to know what the Secretary General's comments are with regard to Cameroon's Minister Delegate of Justices warning to President Biya's opponents that they, quote, might end up like arrogant Jews whom Hitler put in gas chambers. Thank you.
The Secretary General has stood and will continue to stand against any anti-Semitic statements or statements that incite violence. Mr. Biya.
Particularly, I mean, the reference to the Holocaust and the Jews was in the context of what could happen to Cameroonians.
I haven't seen the particular statement, but I'm telling you what our reaction is. Yes, Mr. Bays.
On Yemen, just a little bit of some clarification to the useful statements that you put out. Who is in charge of the RCC now? Because it seems you have two generals.
No, we have
currently in Yemen.
We have one general at a time. So General Lawless Guard has arrived in Yemen, I think, yesterday. And as of this evening, he has taken over the chairmanship of the RCC.
Right.
It was very important for us to have both. There were, let me just put it this way, there were two generals, one chair.
Okay, and in terms of the chair, General Kamat is still on the ship right now. Are those talks have finished that you gave us a readout of, or are they continuing?
I gave you what I knew, which is the talks continued today.
Continued, but do you...
Continued today.
Are you keeping them on that ship for another day?
I think we will go to reporting one day at a time.
So one assumes General Lola's guard, if they are continuing.
Yes,
on the
ship, he is the chair.
He will join the vessel.
He was there.
Vessel.
This was to ensure the smoothest possible handover, which is what we've been talking about. And General Olesgaard assumed his duties as chair and head of the assistance mission as of this evening.
Okay, understood.
Carol. No, you will. 1 second.
Sorry, the statement says the discussions are continuing tomorrow. So,
yeah.
Okay. What is phase one of redeployment?
I would have to refer you back to the text of the agreement. Yeah. Ben.
Yeah, follow up on that. No. Since you have two generals in the room, did they ever get the two sides in the dispute in the same room?
They're on the ship together. That's what we've been reporting.
But are they conducting negotiations with both sides
As far as I know, they're in the same room. They're not in separate berths.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Yep. I think you have to press the light on your microphone. Yep. There we go.
Okay. I have to repeat. Hebel Magrabi, yes. International Daily Bulletin. I have two questions regarding the meeting that took place in the outcome of the Jordanian meeting. It took place yesterday. And regarding the agreement of the release of the Houthis, the release of the hostages, I knew that the Houthis requested only two hostages to be released.
Are you talking about the prisoner exchange?
Yes.
Yeah.
And out of 1,300, so.
I mean, those discussions are ongoing. I don't have any more details. We can ask our colleagues who are on the ground, but I don't have numbers with me here.
We'll
come back to my office. We'll see what more we can get for you.
Okay, thanks.
James.
Thanks, Stefan. One more detail on the Yemen talks, the Hodeidah talks. Do you know the name of the lead negotiator for the Houthi side and the government side? And has it been the same individual in both cases throughout since the talks began in January?
I will check. I will check. Yes, and then Carla. Go ahead. Yes, please.
A report to the UN Sanctions Committee that was obtained by journalists yesterday suggests that North Korea tries to protect and disperse testing, assembly, and storage of its nuclear missile capabilities. Can you confirm that information, or do you have any comment on that?
No, those reports are addressed directly to the Sanctions Committee, Security Council Sanctions Committee. I haven't seen the report, and we don't see them. Those are for Security Council members. Carla.
Thank you. The Times has been publishing very, very large articles about Mr. Alston's report on the effect of austerity measures on increased poverty in England. Do you know how we can get the report, and is there any chance of bringing him here for a press briefing?
The reports usually of the special rapporteurs are online. There is a season during which special rapporteurs tend to migrate to New York, but I think that's in the fall. That being said, he may be available through our colleagues in Geneva. Dulcie.
Yeah, regarding Lala's guard, so how long is his appointment for?
Until further notice. Yes, Benny.
Does Secretary General have any comment on the nomination of David Malpass for World Bank?
No. That's a process that involves the World Bank, its executive board. First of all, I've read the press reports. I'm not aware that it's been officially nominated, but it's a decision that involves the executive board of the World Bank and not the Secretary General of the United Nations. You've been very patient.
Thank you. Again.
There you go.
All right. I have a question because the Secretary Council yesterday, he issued a statement regarding ceasing of fire. But what happened to that, like a couple of hours later? The ceasing of fire between the two parties.
Oh, the ceasefire. Yes, sorry. I'm sorry. Yes.
So what happened to that? The Houthis, 1 hour later, they started shooting. And
So what did the UN, what was the role of the UN in this particular issue?
The ceasefire in Hodeidah has been largely holding. I think what is important that we have not seen either party try to use the ceasefire to gain further territory. The agreement is what it is. It is not unsurprising that there may be some sporadic fire here and there, but as far as we're concerned, it is generally holding.
I'm sorry, just to follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Did the UN condemn any of the Houthis action that happened yesterday? Because after the issuing of the statement, they started shooting. So
I'm not sure that the UN was able to determine the source of any firing. Yes, James. But we call on all parties to continue and observe the ceasefire. You have to hand over the microphone to your neighbor.
I'm coming back to the berths on that ship. Just to be clear, the Houthi delegation came a day after the coalition delegation, I remember that. Mm-hmm. But no one has left the ship. They're not leaving at night. They are all staying on this ship, is your understanding.
That
brings me to my question.
I'm not the steward on the ship, but
you are having both sides and you take them into the ocean onto a ship, explain to me the thinking of sort of cooping them up together and what that might achieve.
Well, they're not at sea. They're berthed. So, I mean, you know, we're not sailing out to sea with them. I think it was a creative solution by our colleagues on the ground to find a place that they could, both parties could agree to go to, a place that is relatively secure. I will leave it to those who have greater experience in managing negotiations as to the psychological effect of putting people on a ship.
NATO has added yet another East European country to its membership roles. The former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia is now a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and Macedonia's Foreign Minister Nikola Dimitrov held a press conference in Brussels on Wednesday following the signing of the Accession Protocol. The nation is now called the Republic of North Macedonia and it's NATO's 30th member. This was the NATO Secretary General and North Macedonian Foreign Minister at the press conference in Brussels Wednesday.
So, Foreign Minister Dimitrov, dear Nikola, it's really great to see you here. Welcome back to the NATO headquarters. You have been here before, but today is a special day because today we signed the accession protocol for your membership in the alliance. Today is a historic day for your country and a proud day for us all. NATO ambassadors have just signed the accession protocol for the future Republic of North Macedonia. I want to congratulate both Skopje and Athens for showing commitment and courage in reaching an agreement on the name issue. We can now look to the future as allies start to ratify the protocol. Once all allies have ratified the protocol, Skopje will become the 30th member of the alliance. Membership will give you a seat at the North Atlantic Council. You will have an equal voice in shaping the decision we take as allies. You already make important contributions to our shared security, contributing to our mission in Afghanistan, promoting regional cooperation in the southeast of Europe, and you're also implementing major reforms. NATO keeps almost 1 billion citizens across Europe and North America secure. And with you joining NATO, there will be 30 countries committed to protect each other. Your accession will bring more stability to the Western Balkans. This is good for the region and for the Euro-Atlantic security. From today, your country will participate in NATO meetings as an invitee. We look forward to welcoming Defense Minister Radmila Shekarinska as early as next week and to inviting Prime Minister Zaev to the leaders' meeting. I'm happy to announce that the leaders' meeting will take place in December in London. London was our first headquarters in 1949, so this is an ideal setting to mark NATO's 70th anniversary. We are grateful to the UK for agreeing to host the meeting and for playing a key role in our alliance over the decades. Nicola, today's signing of the accession protocol shows what diplomacy and statesmanship can achieve. And I really look forward to seeing 30 Allied flags outside the NATO headquarters. So once again, welcome to the NATO headquarters. Congratulations with the signing of the accession protocol. And we look forward to welcoming you at the NATO foreign ministerial meeting in Washington in April. So once again, welcome.
Thank you so much, dear Jens. This is a historic day. It's been a long journey. We've had 18 cycles of the membership action plan, to give you an illustration. And it didn't just happen. I think as with people, for countries as well, history doesn't simply happen. You have to make it happen. And what I did with the North Atlantic Council, I'm going to do also with you, the representatives of the media, the public. I'd like to acknowledge and praise the leadership of Prime Minister Zaev, of Prime Minister Tsipras. It was easier not to do this. So by no means this historic reconciliation was inevitable. It was not even likely. It was easier to sit in the trenches of history. It was easier to even score political points by maintaining the dispute. But what they dared to do was invest political capital for the benefit of the two peoples, of the two nations, and the whole region, and NATO as a family, as an alliance. I pledged our commitment to continue with what we promised, which is continue with the reforms, both on the side of the rule of law, but also on the side of the intelligence sector reforms and the defense modernization. A country is as strong as its military. It is also as strong as its democratic institutions are functional and healthy, but it is also as strong as the number of close friends it has. Our journey is not over. We look forward to parliaments in 29 allies ratifying the accession protocol. But what's important for us is we will never walk alone again. And we stand beside these 29 allies, NATO member states, able and ready to assume the obligations arising from our full membership in NATO. For us, NATO is about making the world more peaceful, more stable. We will do our part when it comes to NATO missions. And we will also do everything that we can to make sure that our region, Southeastern Europe or the Balkans, is a region that is more predictable, more stable, and more prosperous. It's been a great day today. Thank you so much.
Okay, we have a couple time for a couple of questions. Radio Free Europe, at the back here. Yeah.
Breka Josfiak, Radio Free Europe. As for NATO Secretary General, we understand that Macedonia is politically ready, but are they militarily ready as well, considering that they only spend 1% of GDP on military? The budget doesn't look too great there. The military is fairly small. So what do you say about the military preparedness of this potentially new member state?
I think we have to understand that the enlargement of NATO with the future Republic of North Macedonia will strengthen NATO for different reasons. Partly it will contribute to stability in the southeast of Europe. That is important for the whole alliance. But partly they have shown that they can contribute to our shared security because the country is already participating in NATO missions and operations. We exercise together with them. They participate in our mission in Afghanistan. And what we have seen is that they have been able to implement reforms, modernizing their defense institutions, their security institutions, and they have pledged and they have clearly committed to continue to modernize and strengthen their defense institutions and the armed forces. What we have seen is that defense spending is now going up, is increasing, and it's a clear commitment from the government in Skopje to meet the NATO guideline of spending 2% of GDP on defense by 2024. So as many other allies, they adapt, they invest, and I look forward to having them as a full member, because that will strengthen NATO, it will stabilize the region, and it of course will provide the security guarantees for the future Republic of North Macedonia.
Okay, we have the Portuguese TV there.
Thank you. Susana Freixas, SIC Portugal. Actually, my question is on the next meeting of NATO leaders in London. I would like to understand why London, taking into account the Brexit process, and when we don't know whether the UK is going to be part of the EU in December or not. Is there a political message in this decision by, of course, the NATO? Thank you.
So Brexit will change UK's relationship to the European Union, but it will not change the United Kingdom's relationship to NATO. So for me, it's perfectly natural that UK is hosting the leaders' meeting at the end of the next year, not least because London was the first seat for the NATO headquarters back in 1949 when the alliance was established, and the first Secretary General of the alliance was actually a Brit. So Britain, the United Kingdom, is a founding member of NATO, and we started in London with our first headquarters. So we are extremely grateful to the government of the United Kingdom, to Prime Minister May, for the offer to host the next leaders' meeting. And that will be part of the way we mark the 70th anniversary of our alliance.
Okay. Georgian TV in yellow.
Georgian TV, Rustavito Tamara Nutsubidze. First of all, congratulations. And as you know, this day also very important for Georgia, for our people. What do you think? What does it show and what does it mean for Georgia? Thank you.
It shows that NATO's door remains open for countries that meet the NATO standards and that adhere to the NATO values of democracy, the rule of law, and individual liberty. And we are very encouraged by what we see in Georgia, the commitment to reforms, the commitment to strengthening defense and security institutions, transparency, judiciary reforms. And therefore, we welcome also the very clear commitment by NATO leaders at the summit in July that Georgia will become a member of the alliance. They reiterated the decision we made back in Bucharest in 2008. And we have actually stepped up the cooperation with Georgia. We are grateful for all the support Georgia provides to NATO in NATO missions and operations. But also we see that NATO is actually stepping up support and cooperation with Georgia. So we will continue to support Georgia as it moves towards NATO membership.
Open TV, Greece.
Hello, Maria Psara, Open TV, Greece. I don't want to bring bad news, but is there any way that this procedure of Skopje accession in NATO can go wrong? And political resolutions can play any role in both by both countries in NATO? Thank you.
I can start on that. Perhaps Nicolò can add some remarks. But just to say that I'm really impressed by the courage, by the political will, by the commitment of both the government in Athens and the government in Skopje, and especially the leadership of Prime Minister Tsipras and Prime Minister Zaev. Because this is really leaders who have been able to make history, to shape history. And that they have done so by overcoming divisions, solving an issue that has been a big problem for the region, for the countries, and actually also for both the aspirations to enlarge NATO and the European Union.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.